Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Ever feel like understanding the real story behind an investment is like trying to decipher an alien language, and it's written on this tidal wave of data?
Yeah, you're definitely not alone there.
Yeah.
That's kind of the puzzle we're trying to crack today on the deep dive.
Exactly.
We take those, you know, overwhelming mountains of financial articles, all the research, maybe even our own scribbled notes sometimes.
Right.
And we basically chisel away everything but the absolute crucial insights. Think of it like your cheat code to feeling genuinely informed about the financial world.
Without spending weeks buried in the library, yeah.
Precisely.
And for this session, we've got a really great guide, Getting Started in Security Analysis. Now, this isn't about, you know, basic budgeting. This is really getting under the hood of how investments actually work.
Mm-hmm. Understanding those financial statements, the impact of the wider economy, how to put a real value on things, stocks, bonds, even property.
Yeah, so our mission today, it's pretty straightforward. We want to arm you with the core knowledge of security analysis straight from the source, make it practical, digestible, and just cut through all that noise.
And this source, it's a bit of a treasure trove, really. It covers everything from those fundamental financial reports companies put out to the big economic forces, the actual math behind investing.
The quant stuff.
Yeah, the quant stuff. Uh-huh. And then detailed methods for valuing different kinds of investments. So we'll be hitting the highlights in each of these areas, kind of acting as your expert navigators.
Consider this your express ticket to feeling, well, more confident in understanding how the pros analyze investments. By the end of our time together, you should have a much clearer lens to view the financial world through. Okay, let's unpack this.
Sounds good. So the book kicks off by basically establishing why security analysis even exists. Its fundamental purpose is to create a reliable foundation of financial information.
A trusted source you can turn to.
Exactly.
And it's definitely aimed at people ready to go beyond, like, the basic budgeting apps, right?
Oh, for sure. The author specifically targets investors who've maybe got a handle on general financial planning, but they're itching to understand the why. You know, the why behind investment values, how global events ripple through their portfolios.
The next level.
The next level, exactly. And the source material, it's pretty thoughtfully divided into two key sections. Part one really builds that essential groundwork.
The foundations.
Yeah, the core tools, the terms of finance, how prices get set in the markets, the whole landscape of financial research.
And then part two, that's called fundamental financial security analysis. That's where we get down to the nitty-gritty.
That's it. How to actually figure out what a company's securities are worth, whether that's their stock, you know, ownership, or their bonds, which represent debt.
And what's interesting is how they connect, right? You can't jump to the fancy stuff without the basics.
Absolutely. The book really makes that clear. Those sophisticated valuation techniques you see later on, they completely depend on understanding the foundational tools and concepts from the first part. You can't really assess if a company's a good bet without speaking the basic financial language.
All right, so let's start building that vocabulary, those foundational tools. The book starts with accounting, which it calls the tabulating and bookkeeping of capital resources. Maybe not thrilling, but it's the language of business.
It absolutely is. Accounting statements are how companies tell their financial story. But, and this is a crucial point the book makes, these statements are like raw data.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just scream buy or sell. You need to analyze them. Dig into them carefully to uncover real insights about future potential. Think of it like a doctor looking at your vital signs.
The numbers aren't the diagnosis.
Exactly. They're critical clues, but you need the analysis.
Okay, so deciphering those clues.
Yeah.
What are, let's say, the three key financial statements we absolutely need to get our heads around?
Right, the essential trio. The balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement. Each one gives you a unique perspective on a company's financial health.
Let's start with the balance sheet. What's the core idea, the main insight we get from looking at one?
Well, the key insight is that a healthy balance sheet provides resilience. It's like a financial cushion for downturns, and it gives the company the firepower for growth opportunities. It's essentially a snapshot. What a company owns its assets versus what it owes its liabilities at one specific point in time.
And the difference is the equity, the net worth.
That's it. And the book points out assets aren't just cash. They could be things like factories, land, which might even be sitting on the books at their original cost, potentially undervalued.
Ah, so a sharp investor might spot hidden value there.
Precisely. The book even mentions the idea of an asset hound. You know, looking for those situations. It touches on that value investing idea that sometimes the sum of the parts is worth more than the whole company's stock price suggests.
Okay, makes sense. Now let's shift to the income statement. What's the core takeaway there? Is it just profit?
Well, it tells us if a company is making money over a specific period, yes. It's the profit and loss report, essentially.
Right, revenue minus expenses equals net income.
Exactly. But the book really emphasizes looking at just one quarter or even 1 year. That gives you a very limited view. The real insight comes from analyzing trends over several years.
See the movie, not just one frame.
That's a great way to put it. You need to understand the sustainability, the trajectory of the business.
Okay. And then the third one, the cash flow statement. How does that give us a different angle?
So the cash flow statement tracks the actual cash coming in and going out. While the income statement can include non-cash items, like depreciation.
Right, an accounting charge.
Exactly. The cash flow statement focuses purely on the movement of money. And the book highlights one part as particularly critical, cash flow from operations.
Okay, why that one specifically?
Because that shows how much cash the core business selling its products or services is actually generating. Analysts often see this as a really key indicator of management's ability, the underlying strength of the company.
Gotcha. The book mentions two ways to calculate this, direct and indirect methods. Do we need to get bogged down in that?
You know, for most investors starting out, probably not. Both methods get you to the same cash flow from operations number. The indirect method is way more common. It starts with net income and adjusts.
So focus on the final number and what it means.
Exactly. Understand what that operating cash flow represents. That's the main takeaway.
Okay. Back to the income statement for a sec. There are some key line items there too, like operating expenses, SG&A, right?
Yeah.
Selling, general, and administrative. What do those tell us?
Yeah, SG&A. Those reveal how efficiently a company is managing its day-to-day operations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like salaries, marketing, rent. If sales are growing, but these expenses are growing even faster, that could be a red flag.
Lack of discipline.
Could be. It warrants a closer look.
And then there's EBITDA. That acronym gets thrown around a lot. Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. The book calls it a measure of cash flow. Why is that important?
Think of EBITDA as the raw cash the business generates from its core operations before you factor in financing costs, that's the interest, government obligations, taxes, and those non-cash accounting charges, depreciation and amortization.
So it strips out some noise.
It gives you a clear picture of the underlying profitability of the business itself. It's helpful for comparing companies with different debt levels or tax situations.
Okay. And speaking of depreciation and amortization, the book calls them the estimated cost for future replacement of assets. So it's like saying stuff wears out.
Exactly. Depreciation is for tangible stuff, machinery, buildings. Amortization is for intangible things, patents, trademarks. It's the accounting way of spreading the cost of those assets over the time they're expected to be useful.
And the book uses a practical example, right? Something about a special order.
Yeah. Question one. That's a good one. It shows a company with some spare production capacity getting a one-time order. By understanding which costs go up with the order, the variable costs like materials and which stay the same, fixed costs like rent.
They can figure out if it's worth it?
Precisely. They see that even at a slightly lower price per unit, accepting the order can still boost overall operating income. It shows how this accounting info directly feeds into business decisions.
And quickly, managerial accounting, how's that different?
Oh, that's more internal. It's accounting focused on providing info inside the company, helping management make decisions, plan, control operations. Less about reporting to us, the outside investors.
Got it. Okay, so we've got some accounting basics down. Now, the book shifts gears to economics, the big picture stuff. Why is understanding the broader economy so crucial for analyzing individual stocks or bonds?
Well, because every single company operates within that economic landscape, right?
Uh-huh.
You need context. Is the economy booming? Is it slowing down? And how does this specific company usually behave? Does it rise and fall with the tide cyclical, or does it do the opposite countercyclical?
That context is key for assessing its future.
Absolutely.
And how do these big economic trends actually hit the value of our investments?
One key link the book highlights is interest rates. It's fundamental. When interest rates rise, the present value of a company's future earnings tends to fall.
Why is that?
Think about it. If you can suddenly get a higher return on a super safe investment, like a government bond, then the potential future profits from a riskier investment, like a stock, look less attractive today.
So when the Fed talks about changing rates...
Big signal for investors.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the book also points out something important. Don't just look at the economic news itself. Compare it to what the experts were expecting, the consensus estimates.
Ah, the surprise factor.
Exactly. A big surprise in the data, positive or negative, can really move markets.
Okay. Now, navigating all this economic data can feel overwhelming. The book tries to help by structuring the key indicators, breaking them down into categories.
Yeah, it's really helpful. It organizes a whole bunch of data points into logical groups. Like, mm-hmm. you get indicators for...
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Employment and unemployment, think payroll changes, the unemployment rate, gives you a pulse on the labor market.
Okay.
Then there are income and production indicators, GDP, industrial production showing the economy's overall output.
And it also mentions leading indicators, things that might hint at where we're heading.
Exactly. Things like the index of leading economic indicators itself, growth in the money supply, mm-hmm. consumer confidence surveys,
yeah.
stuff that might change before the broader economy does.
And then there are coincident and lagging indicators, too.
Right. Coincident reflect the current state, lagging change after a trend is established.
And prices, obviously critical. The consumer price index, CPI, and the producer price index, PPI. What's the difference there?
CPI tracks inflation from the consumer's perspective, the average price change for a basket of goods and services we buy. PPI does the same, but from the producer's viewpoint, the prices they get for their output. The GDP deflator is another broad inflation measure.
And the book lists a ton more manufacturing data, corporate profits, auto sales, housing starts.
Yeah, it covers a lot. Each gives you a different piece of the economic puzzle. The categorization really helps make sense of it all.
Definitely. Now, the book also dives into international economics, which feels more important than ever, right, with globalization.
Oh, absolutely. The book points out how companies operating globally are hit by currency swings, face wider competition. Globalization has even been linked to keeping inflation lower in some developed countries because of that overseas price pressure.
And there are a couple of key concepts here. Purchasing power parity, PPP, and interest rate parity, IRP. Let's start with PPP. Simple terms, what's the idea?
Okay, PPP. Think of it like this. Over the long haul, the exchange rate between two currencies should adjust so that the same stuff costs roughly the same amount in both countries once you convert the price.
Like the Big Mac Index, sort of?
Kind of, yeah. If a coffee costs $3 in the U.S. and maybe $2.50 in Europe, PPP suggests the exchange rate should eventually move towards a point where $3 buys $2.50.
And the book has a quick way to estimate this using inflation rates.
Right. It suggests if, say, France has higher inflation than the U.S., the euro would be expected to weaken against the dollar over time, roughly by that inflation difference, to keep purchasing power balanced.
Okay. And then interest rate parity, IRP, what's that about?
IRP basically says the difference in interest rates between two countries should equal the difference between the current exchange rate, the spot rate, and the future expected exchange rate, the forward rate.
Why should they be equal?
It's to stop easy risk-free profits. If they weren't equal, you could just borrow money where interest rates are low, invest it where rates are high, lock in the future exchange rate, and make guaranteed money. Market forces usually adjust the forward rates to stop that arbitrage.
Arbitrage, right. The book uses an example with Danish kroner and U.S. dollars to show how that might work if IRP didn't hold.
Exactly. Borrow low-rate dollars, convert to high-rate kroner, lock in the rate to convert back. Boom. Profit. But, as the book notes, those kinds of risk-free opportunities, they usually vanish super fast in efficient markets because traders jump on them.
So these parity conditions, they're like theoretical anchors, not exact rules minute to minute.
That's a really good way to put it. They're equilibrium points that market forces are always kind of nudging things towards. Real-world stuff can cause deviations, but understanding the concepts gives you a valuable framework for thinking about currencies and international investing.
Okay, accounting, economics, check. Now let's get into the math. Quantitative analysis, making sense of the numbers. This section seems focused on the calculations that are just fundamental to investing.
That's right. And the book really stresses, you know, it's not just about memorizing formulas. It's about understanding how they apply in real investment situations. Working through examples helps it sink in. We're talking future value, present value, rate of return.
It starts with future value, FV, and present value, PV. What's the core question each one answers?
Future value answers. If I invest X amount today at Y rate, what's it worth later? Present value is the opposite. What's some future amount of money worth today, given a certain return I could earn elsewhere? The book gives clear examples for both.
Like, what's $1,000 invested for 19 years at 5% worth?
Right. And the calculation shows it grows to over $2,500. That really highlights the power of compounding over the long term. Another example looks at the present value of getting $643 in 3 years, discounted at 11%. Turns out you'd only need about $470 today to get there.
Compounding is key. The book also talks about figuring out how long it takes for an investment to double. That's a common question.
Yeah. It asks how long it takes $300 to become $600 at 6% return. The math says about 12 years. And it introduces the handy rule of 72 as a quick mental shortcut.
Rule of 72.
Yeah, just divide 72 by the annual interest rate. So 72 divided by 6 gives you 12, a pretty good estimate for doubling time.
Nice shortcut. Okay, next up, net present value. Or NPV. This sounds critical for deciding if an investment is actually worth doing.
Oh, absolutely. NPV helps you figure that out. You compare the present value of all the cash you expect to get from the investment to the present value of all the cash you put into it.
So inflows versus outflows in today's money.
Exactly. If the NPV is positive, the investment is generally expected to create value. The book has an example showing a positive NPV, suggesting it's a go. It even mentions NPV can help you figure out the maximum you could possibly invest and still expect a positive return.
And then there's internal rate of return, IRR. How's that different from NPV?
IRR is the discount rate that makes the NPV exactly zero. Think of it as the investment's estimated rate of return over its life. If that IRR is higher than your required rate of return, the minimum you need to justify the risk, then it might look attractive.
Okay. The book also covers annuities, those regular payments over time, calculating their future and present value. When do we use those?
Super useful for things like retirement savings plans, where you're making regular contributions, or for figuring out the value today of a stream of future payments, like loan repayments. The book gives the formulas FVFA and PVFA and walks through examples.
The underlying theme here really seems to be the time value of money. Money today is worth more than money tomorrow.
Precisely. That's fundamental. The book hammers home that just looking at total return without when you get it can be really misleading. Compounded returns, where earnings get reinvested, that's what shows the true long-term growth picture.
Okay, moving beyond those core calcs, the book dips into some basic stats for investing. Starts with the mean, the average. What's the big caution there?
The caution is that the mean, the average, can hide a lot of variation. If you've got some really high numbers and some really low ones, the average might not reflect the typical experience at all. It's a starting point, but you need more.
Right. That's where variance and standard deviation come in, measuring the spread, the risk.
Exactly. Variance and its square root, standard deviation, quantify how spread out the data points are. In investing, a higher standard deviation means a wider range of possible outcomes, which generally translates to higher risk.
And with standard deviation, we can think about confidence limits, like the probability of outcomes falling within a certain range.
Yes. Assuming things follow a normal distribution, that classic bell curve standard deviation helps estimate likelihoods. About 68% of outcomes fall within one standard deviation of the mean. 95% within 2, 99% within 3. The book uses an earnings per share example to show how this gives investors a feel for the potential range of future earnings.
It also mentions the geometric mean. When do we use that instead of the regular arithmetic mean for returns?
You use the geometric mean for averaging returns over multiple periods, especially if there's volatility. It gives a more accurate picture of the actual compounded growth rate over time, unlike the arithmetic mean, which can get skewed by big up or down years.
Got it. And finally, in this section, regression analysis. Sounds a bit more advanced. What's the basic idea for investors?
The basic idea is seeing if there's a historical relationship between different financial factors. Regression tries to understand how one thing, like a stock price, the dependent variable, might be influenced by others, like interest rates or economic growth, the independent variables.
Like the book's example of snowfall and snow shovel sales.
Exactly. Trying to predict sales based on snow. In investing, maybe you'd look at interest rates and housing prices. But, big caveat, correlation isn't causation. You need good data and a sensible economic reason for the link to be meaningful.
Phew. Okay, that was a workout on the numbers. Now we're moving into part two of the book, Fundamental Financial Security Analysis, applying these tools to understand actual companies. It starts by stressing the importance of context, understanding a company's place within its industry. Why is that step one?
Well, because a company's success isn't just about what it does internally, right? It's hugely influenced by the competitive playground it's in. Understanding that industry's dynamics, the company's strengths and weaknesses compared to rivals, the overall health of that industry, it's crucial for assessing its long-term chances. You got to look beyond the company itself.
And the book provides a security analysis checklist to guide that. What kind of high-level questions are on there?
It prompts you to think about the big picture. Is the economy helping or hurting this industry? What's the company's actual business model, its main markets? How's it financed its capital structure? And then digging into the financials. What do the recent income statements, cash flows, balance sheets tell you about its health and trends? It's a solid framework for that initial homework.
It mentions the importance of a strong balance sheet again. What are we looking for as a sign of strength beyond just the definition?
A strong balance sheet usually means plenty of liquid assets, like cash, manageable debt levels, and valuable long-term assets. As the book notes, value investors often hunt for companies where the underlying asset value might not be fully baked into the stock price. A healthy balance sheet gives you that cushion, that resilience.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
We talked about.
And when we dig into those financial statements, it's not just the numbers, but understanding the accounting choices management made. Why does that matter so much?
Because those choices can significantly shape the reported results. Are they using conservative accounting, maybe understating earnings a bit, or more liberal accounting, painting a potentially rosier picture? Understanding their depreciation methods, how they recognize revenue, the overall quality of their earnings, that gives you crucial insight into how reliable and sustainable those reported numbers really are. You have to look past the headlines.
Okay, now we're getting into the real meat. Equity, analysis, and valuation. Trying to figure out what a share of stock is actually worth. The book makes an interesting point early on. Just because a company did poorly in the past doesn't mean it's doomed. What's the key thing that can change the story?
Often it's management. A skilled ethical management team can really turn things around, implement new strategies, allocate capital wisely, improve future prospects. But the book rightly warns, assessing management isn't just reading press releases.
Right, you need to look deeper.
Yeah, look at their track record, their strategic vision, how they spend the company's money, how open they are with shareholders. It's more art than science sometimes.
One framework the book introduces for sizing up the industry is Porter's Five Forces. Can you give us a quick rundown of those forces and why they matter for stocks?
Sure. Porter's Five Forces helps you gauge how competitive and potentially profitable an industry is. It looks at 1, the threat of new entrants. How easy is it for new players to jump in? 2, bargaining power of suppliers. How much can suppliers dictate terms or prices? 3, bargaining power of buyers. How much clout do customers have? 4, threat of substitutes. Are there other ways customers can get the same need met? And 5, the rivalry among existing firms. How intense is the direct competition?
So analyzing those gives you a sense of the industry's attractiveness.
Exactly. And the potential for companies within it to make sustainable profits. The book uses the router market as an example to show how these forces might play out. High barriers to entry, maybe. Powerful suppliers if components are proprietary.
Seems like a really useful lens for understanding the competitive pressures. The book also mentions common size financial statements. What's the benefit of looking at financials that way?
Common size statements express everything as a percentage. Like on the income statement, everything's a percentage of revenue. On the balance sheet, a percentage of total assets. This makes it way easier to compare a company's performance over time, even as it grows, and crucially, to compare it to competitors of different sizes.
So you can see if their cost structure is out of whack compared to peers.
Precisely. You can spot trends and differences much more clearly.
And then financial ratios, another huge tool. The book covers liquidity, asset management, and leverage ratios. What does each category tell us, broadly?
Okay, liquidity ratios, like the current ratio, quick ratio, they measure the company's ability to pay its short-term bills. Can it meet its immediate obligations? Asset management ratios, inventory turnover, accounts receivable turnover show how efficiently the company is using its assets to generate sales. Is inventory sitting around too long? Are customers paying quickly?
And
leverage ratios, debt to equity is a big one, show how much debt the company is using to finance itself. High leverage can boost returns when things are good, but it definitely increases risk, especially in a downturn. Too much debt can be dangerous.
It also stresses reading the footnotes in financial statements. What kind of juicy details might be hiding there?
Oh, the footnotes are critical. You can find info on off-balance sheet liabilities, things not directly on the main statement. Contingent liabilities, potential future obligations, details about debt schedules, investments, accounting policies. Savvy analysts often find really important clues or early warnings buried in those notes. Never skip the footnotes.
Good tip. The book also talks about different ways companies grow. Same-store sales, new products, acquisitions. How should we think about those when analyzing a company?
You need to understand how they're growing and if it's sustainable. Is it just price hikes? Is it actual volume growth? Are new products catching on? Are acquisitions being integrated well? You need to identify the key drivers of growth to assess if it's likely to continue and how profitable that growth is.
Okay, when it comes to actually putting a dollar value on a stock, the book introduces the Capital Asset Pricing Model, or CAPM. What's the core idea there?
CAPM is a foundational model for estimating the return an investor should require from a stock, given its risk compared to the overall market. It uses the stock's beta, its volatility relative to the market, plus the risk-free rate, like a treasury bond yield, and the expected market return.
And that gives you a discount rate for valuation.
Exactly. It helps determine the appropriate discount rate to use when valuing the stock's future expected cash flows.
And the book covers a few valuation techniques, starting with ratio analysis. How do we use ratios like PE or price to book to gauge value?
With ratio analysis, you compare a company's key valuation ratios, price to earnings, price to book, price to sales, EV to EBITDA to its own history, to its competitors, and to the market overall. If a company's ratios are way higher than its peers, without a clear reason like much faster growth, it might suggest it's overvalued. Lower ratios could signal undervaluation. It's all about context and comparison.
Benchmarking. Okay. Another big one is discounted cash flow, or DCF. What's the basic principle?
The core idea of DCF is that a company's value today is simply the sum of all the free cash flow it's expected to generate in the future, discounted back to their present value.
So you project future cash flows and discount them back.
Exactly. You project cash flows year by year, maybe for 5 or 10 years, then estimate a terminal value and discount everything back using that rate we got from CAPM or something similar. The sum is your estimate of intrinsic value. The book really stresses making realistic assumptions about growth and doing sensitivity analysis, seeing how the value changes if your assumptions are a bit off.
It sounds like valuation is definitely more art than science, like the book says.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just plugging numbers into a spreadsheet. It requires deep understanding of the business, the industry, management, the economy. Valuation usually gives you a range, not a single magic number. It requires judgment.
Okay, let's switch gears completely now. Understanding debt credit analysis. The book immediately points out the bondholder relationship is different from the shareholder one. What's the main focus for a bondholder?
Right. Shareholders want growth, capital gains, maybe dividends. Bondholders, they're lenders. Their primary concern is getting their interest payments on time, every time, and getting their original principal back when the bond matures. It's more about avoiding loss than maximizing gain.
Safety first. The book mentions that early on, credit analysis was the main game in town for investment analysis. So what fundamentals does a credit analyst look at?
A key starting point is the bond's legal agreement, the indenture. That lays out all the rules, interest rate, maturity date, and crucially, any protective covenants. These are rules designed to protect bondholders, like limits on how much more debt the company can take on or restrictions on selling assets.
Gotcha. The book also mentions different bond types. Government, corporate, municipal. What's the big perk of municipal bonds or munis?
The big attraction for many munis is tax exemption. The interest income is often free from federal income tax and sometimes state and local taxes too. This makes them particularly appealing for investors in higher tax brackets. The book even gives a formula to calculate the taxable equivalent yield, TEY.
So you can compare them fairly to taxable bonds.
Exactly.
And then bond ratings, those letter grades from Moody's, S&P, what do they signify?
Bond ratings are basically an opinion on the issuer's creditworthiness, how likely they are to repay their debt. Investment grade ratings mean lower perceived risk, while high yield or junk ratings mean higher perceived risk, but usually offer higher interest rates to compensate. The book does briefly mention the potential conflict of interest since issuers pay the agencies for the ratings.
Worth keeping in mind, to dig deeper into a company's ability to handle debt, credit analysts use ratios, some familiar from equity analysis.
Yes, definitely. Liquidity ratios, current ratio, asset test check, short-term bill paying ability. Leverage ratios, debt to equity, debt to capitalization, show the overall debt burden. And then coverage ratios are really important here.
Coverage ratios?
Okay. Yeah, like EBIT divided by interest expense or EBITDA divided by interest expense. They show how comfortably the company's earnings can cover its interest payments.
Mm-hmm.
A higher ratio means more breathing room, more safety for bondholders.
Another critical piece of info, usually in the footnotes again, the schedule of debt maturities. Why is that so vital?
Because it shows when all the company's debt comes due. A company might look fine now, covering its interest, but if it has a huge chunk of debt maturing next year, a maturity wall, it could face refinancing risk. Can it roll over the debt? Can it pay it back? That schedule is key.
The book also brings up earnings quality again. How does that relate to credit analysis?
Lenders, bondholders, they want to see consistent, sustainable earnings from solid accounting practices. Earnings puffed up by aggressive accounting that's low quality, less reassuring. They prefer companies with conservative, high quality earnings. It suggests the ability to repay is more reliable.
And bond seniority, what does that mean in practice?
It's about the pecking order if things go bad, like in bankruptcy. Senior bonds have a higher claim on the company's assets than junior or subordinated bonds. So senior bondholders are more likely to get more of their money back if the company goes under. They're generally less risky.
Okay. And finally, bond yields and spreads. What key info do those give us?
A bond's yield is its return. A spread is the difference in yield between, say, a corporate bond and a safer benchmark like a U.S. Treasury bond with a similar maturity. Spreads are measured in basis points hundreds of a percent.
And what does a widening spread mean?
Usually, a widening spread means investors perceive more credit risk in the corporate bond. They're demanding a higher yield premium to compensate for that increased risk. A tightening spread suggests perceived risk is decreasing. But the book warns with an example, don't just look at the spread number, understand the underlying credit story.
So credit analysis is really about assessing the borrower's ability and willingness to pay back the loan.
That's the core of it. And ratings are a shortcut, but not the whole story.
Okay, let's pivot to something tangible, real estate. The book introduces this as a major asset class. What are the main ways to invest?
You can go direct bricks and mortar, as the book calls it, owning your home, a rental property, an office building. Or you can invest indirectly through securities like real estate investment trusts, REITs, or mortgage-backed securities, MBS.
And the book breaks down different property types, residential, commercial, office, retail, industrial, hotels, and others, and distinguishes owning versus renting, key financial differences.
Ownership means big upfront costs, ongoing expenses like taxes and upkeep, but also potential appreciation and maybe rental income. Renting means regular payments for use, but you avoid those ownership headaches and costs. Very different financial profiles.
The book gets into specific real estate finance terms, net operating income, NOI, and cash flow, before financing, CFBF. What do these tell us about a property?
NOI is key. It's the property's income from rent, minus its operating expenses, but before debt payments or big capital improvements. It shows the property's core profitability. CFBF then takes NOI and subtracts capital expenditures, giving you the cash flow available before you deal with the mortgage.
What drives real estate value? It's not just the building itself, right?
Oh, no. Lots of factors. The physical condition, sure. But also local demographics, the overall economy, government rules, supply and demand in that specific market, nearby amenities, infrastructure. It's complex.
And what market indicators should we watch to get a feel for the market's health?
Things like sales volume, new and existing homes, lease completions, the vacancy rate, how much space is empty, the absorption rate, how fast is vacant space getting filled, and how long properties are sitting on the market.
The book also explains mortgages, mortgager, mortgagee, and the mortgage constant. What's the practical use of that constant?
The mortgage constant is a number that helps you quickly calculate the total annual debt service principal and interest for a loan. You multiply the loan amount by the constant for that specific interest rate and term. It helps investors quickly estimate the cash flow impact of financing.
And when analyzing the loans themselves, what metrics matter?
Key ones are loan-to-value, LTV, how much debt versus the property's value, debt service coverage ratio, DSCR, can the property's income cover the loan payments, plus the legal terms, default definitions, recourse versus non-recourse, and any loan covenants the borrower has to follow.
It mentions different loan types, too. Conventional insured adjustable rate, ARMs, subordinated debt like mezzanine. What's a key difference between conventional and insured?
Insured loans, like FHA or VA loans, often need smaller down payments, but you pay mortgage insurance. Conventional loans usually need bigger down payments, no insurance cost. Subordinated debt is riskier, sits behind senior debt, so it costs more. Bridge loans are short-term fixes.
Then we get into mortgage-backed securities, MBS. These got a bad rap in 2008. High level, what's the concept?
The concept is pooling lots of individual mortgages together and selling slices of that pool to investors. It lets investors get exposure to the mortgage market indirectly, and it provides cash back to lenders so they can make more loans.
And the book mentions tranches, different risk levels within one MBS. Why slice it up like that?
To appeal to different investor risk appetites. Senior tranches get paid first, they're lower risk. Mezzanine tranches are in the middle. Junior or BP's tranches take the first losses if mortgages default, so they're higher risk, but offer higher potential returns. It's about tailoring the risk.
And when loans in the pool go bad, who handles the mess?
Usually there's a primary servicer handling routine payments. But if a loan gets into serious trouble, it often gets transferred to a special servicer who specializes in workouts, foreclosures, trying to minimize losses for the MBS investors.
The book also touches on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government's role. Key takeaway there.
These government-sponsored enterprises, GSEs, play a huge role. They buy mortgages, package them into MBS, and often guarantee payments. This helps standardize things and keeps mortgage rates lower than they might otherwise be. But their exact role and government backing is always a topic of debate.
When analyzing an MBS, the book says look at three levels: the properties, the loans, and the bond structure itself. And prepayment risk is a big deal.
Yes, huge. Prepayment risk is the chance homeowners pay off their mortgages early. Maybe they sell the house or refinance. This messes up the expected cash flow stream for MBS investors, especially for certain tranches, and impacts their return.
Okay, last real estate topic, REITs, real estate investment trusts. Basic appeal.
REITs let you invest in a portfolio of income-producing real estate malls, offices, apartments, without owning the properties directly. A big plus is they generally have to pay out most of their taxable income as dividends, so they're popular for income investors.
And there are different types: equity, mortgage, hybrid.
Right. Equity REITs own and operate properties. That's the most common type. Mortgage REITs invest in mortgages and MBS. Hybrids do a bit of both. They can be publicly traded like stocks, privately held, or non-traded.
What are the key metrics for analyzing REITs?
Funds from operations, FFO, is crucial. It's generally seen as a better measure of a REIT's operating cash flow than standard net income, net asset value, NAV, and estimate of the underlying property value. Also, occupancy rates, tenant diversification, their pipeline for future deals, and ratios like AFO, FAD, DSCR, debt to market cap, and liquidity is absolutely critical for REITs.
The book even has a REIT portfolio example, right, to make calculating NEV and stuff concrete.
Yes, it walks through applying those metrics, which is really helpful.
Okay, deep breath. We've made it to the final chapter, the investment management process. Putting it all together. It starts with modern portfolio theory, MPT, but with a warning.
Yeah, the warning is that MPT is a great framework for thinking about diversification and risk versus return. But it kind of assumes investors are always perfectly rational.
Yeah.
And we know from behavioral finance, well, people aren't always rational. Emotions, biases creep in.
But the core idea of diversification spreading investments still holds. Why does that reduce risk?
Because different types of assets, stocks, bonds, real estate, don't usually move perfectly in sync. When one is down, another might be up, or at least less down. This smooths out the overall ride for your portfolio. The key is finding assets with low correlation to each other. Though the book notes, in big crises, correlations can sometimes spike up.
The book lays out a four-step investment management process. What are the stages?
Step one, really understand the investor's needs, goals, constraints. Step two, understand the capital markets, expected returns, risks. Step three, build and implement the actual portfolio based on steps one and two. And step four, monitor everything, make adjustments over time.
Step one sounds crucial, knowing the client. The book talks about the investment policy statement, IPS. What's that for?
The IPS is like the constitution for the portfolio. It's a written document outlining the investor's objectives, growth, income, preservation, their risk tolerance, time horizon, liquidity needs, tax situation, any unique issues. It keeps everyone focused and ensures decisions align with the investor's actual goals, not just chasing market fads. The book stresses asset allocation should flow from this IPS.
It also mentions investor personalities in the life cycle. How do those affect strategy?
Knowing if someone's analytical or passive helps tailor the approach. And the life cycle matters hugely. Younger folks in the accumulation phase can usually take more risk, focus on growth. Mid-career, consolidation phase, maybe more balance. Later, in the spending phase, focus shifts to income and preserving capital. The book uses a doctor example for the accumulation phase challenges.
The book touches on market history stocks beating inflation long term and uses portfolio examples with standard deviation to show risk return. Core message.
The core message is that higher potential returns historically from equities come with higher volatility risk. You need to understand that trade-off, accept the level of risk you're taking, and make sure your asset mix matches your tolerance and time frame. Asset allocation is key, but it's not magic. And style like growth versus value matters too.
Finally, the book tackles a really important topic, ethical issues in the investment industry. Why is this so critical?
Because trust is everything in finance. The book highlights key ethical duties. Loyalty, always putting the client's interest first. That's fiduciary duty. Avoiding conflicts of interest. Maintaining confidentiality. A big one, understanding and avoiding insider trading.
Trading on non-public info.
Exactly, using material non-public information. The book mentions the different theories behind insider trading rules and stresses how important it is for firms to have strong policies, watch lists, restricted lists, information barriers, Chinese walls to prevent it. Ethics are foundational.
Wow. Okay, that was an incredibly thorough deep dive into getting started in security analysis. We really covered a huge amount of ground, from accounting language, the economy, the math, then analyzing stocks, bonds, real estate.
And finally, putting it all together in the investment process, plus the ethics. Our goal today was really to give you, our listener, a solid grounding in these core principles. Hopefully you feel, I don't know, a bit more equipped now to navigate the financial world.
Yeah, to have a better framework for understanding how professional investors think and analyze. So as you continue on your own financial journey, maybe keep this in mind. The markets, they'll keep changing. New tech, new products, always something new. But those fundamental principles we talked about, understanding financial health, economic forces, figuring out intrinsic value, those things are pretty timeless. So here's your food for thought. How will you take these foundational ideas and apply them to your own decisions? How will you keep exploring these fascinating areas?
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.